there's just no correlation between detected LDL levels at baseline and resulting plaque.
On this week's podcast, I had the pleasure of talking to my friend, Dave Feldman. Dave recently released a study that was done with Dr. Matthew Budoff, a well-known cardiac radiologist at the Lundquist Institute connected with UCLA, looking at the progression of heart disease, atherosclerosis, in a cohort of people with elevated LDL and comparing that to a cohort of healthy individuals who didn't have elevated LDL. I'll let you guys listen to the podcast to hear about the results, but I think they are striking. The kind of things I've been talking about for a long time on this podcast, contextual ideas around LDL and ApoB in relation to cardiovascular risk. These findings are quite striking, and I think that they raise a lot of important questions, and I hope they are the beginning of a lot of important research for all of us so that we can truly understand how to best decrease our risk of cardiovascular disease moving forward. Enjoy the podcast with Dave Feldman. These results are striking. Dave Feldman, thanks for coming back on the podcast, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Paul.
Again, I blew the best joke of the podcast just right before the podcast. I'm so excited to talk about this study that you just released with Matt Budoff and the Lundquist Institute. And right as we were starting the podcast, I said, congratulations on the new child. And you should just tell me what you said so that everybody understands what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So my wife and I, we don't have children, but the running joke is that this study is like the one child, but the joke is more that it's my child than it is hers. So she's, you know, it's a stepchild, and we're waiting for it to graduate and leave the nest, and it's getting close to graduation. So this was great because it completed its first stage, I guess you could say, an unexpected aside with this new match analysis.
Yeah, it's almost like the stepchild graduated high school or college or something.
Yeah, that would be kind of a way of putting it.
Yeah, so let's talk about it. I mean, this is what I wanted to have you on the podcast to talk about in detail, because there's been stuff on Twitter, and I recently did a podcast with Derek from More Plates, More Dates, and we talked a lot about lipids and risk of cardiovascular disease. And I think your study is something that you and I have been talking about on podcasts for years. And so the first phase of this is out, and I'll just let you talk to us about it and what you guys found. Let's hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, the first and most important thing to emphasize is this study, at the time that we were putting it together, it's longitudinal. It's on this phenotype that I know you've talked about, that I've talked about, all of us have talked about, that I designated in 2017 in a blog post. It was a bit speculative at the time. It's just that it was pattern recognition. I kept seeing this triad of high LDL cholesterol, high HDL cholesterol, low triglycerides, with a lot of people who are metabolically healthy in the low carb space. But in particular, there seemed to be, especially if somebody was very athletic, but also very low carb and very lean, they tended to have this triad at a more extreme level, to where HDL cholesterol would be very high along with very high LDL. So this is the triad of lean mass hyperresponders. It's an LDL of 200 or higher, HDL of 80 or higher, and triglycerides of 70 or lower. And it's important to emphasize that those three things I just mentioned, all three of them are rare in the general population. You don't typically come up with those. For all three of them to be the same, I kind of put it out there in 2017, just like called it that, but I didn't actually know how many, and it ended up exploding. Whole bunch of people came out of the woodwork on social media, said, "That's me. I'm this person." And that became kind of a big deal. At that point, I said, "Oh, okay, well then this kind of matches the lipid energy model, which I've talked to you about before on prior podcasts. We need to study it. And of course, this would be a great population to study risk in, because we just never had it before, where we would have the variable of interest, right? LDL, ApoB containing lipoproteins. We've never had it isolated without some form of dysfunction in lipid metabolism or some kind of acquired disease. And it just seems like such an obvious scientific choice to go ahead and to study this population." And that was the genesis of the study.
Let's talk about that before we talk about the results of the study. This population, of whom I used to have that phenotype, I have a lot of carbohydrates now. My LDL, my ApoB/LDL are still, quote, high. The last two ApoBs I've had were like 93 and 130. But generally, my ApoB is around 120 milligrams per deciliter now, and my LDL is about 140 to 150. And that's eating a lot of carbohydrates. But this is an interesting thing, because when I was strict carnivore, my LDL went above 200. My LDL was 300 at times. It kind of kept going up and up. I've always been very lean, as you said. So I was one of these, quote, lean mass hyper responders, which is your, it's a term that you coined. It's a phenotype. It's something we observe. And I thought throughout this process of getting to know you and talking about this, that this was a really interesting example of an elevated, quote, LDL slash ApoB level in people that also are not, as you've pointed out to me, and as we've talked about, metabolically unhealthy. These people have, I would say, low fasting insulin levels, which we can define, and they don't have other genetic issues like FH. So what happens a lot is these elevated levels of LDL get conflated with FH, familial hypercholesterolemia. And I should have said at the beginning of this podcast, this one may be a little technical. All of my podcasts with Dave tend to be, but I'll try to make this more accessible for all of you guys listening. So there is this, I would say, genotype. There is this familial hypercholesterolemia genotype, whereby people have a genetic reason over 200 different polymorphisms slash mutations, they get high levels of LDL cholesterol. So there's two points I just want to highlight there. Number one, talk to us about why these two are not the same. This is something you and I have talked about on podcasts in the past, why familial hypercholesterolemia is not the same physiology as a lean mass hyperresponder or someone like myself who has an LDL of 160, but is metabolically healthy. And then, is FH a phenotype or a genotype? Because I'm in sort of a standing disagreement with people over this. I've heard people say, oh, FH is a phenotype. And I say, it's not a freaking, it's a genotype. It's a genetic mutation that leads to this. And people, no, it's a phenotype, which to me is just, this is just hand-waving semantics. And it's kind of silly.
It's, I mean, the bottom line is, by medical established literature at this point, and particularly of diagnosis, it is a phenotype, as in your, for example, for a while there, the criterion, it may have changed since, is that once you reach a certain level of LDL, you're automatically FH. And I think it was at 190 and above. It may be that there's additional criteria that they apply now, such as family history of others who have high LDL or family history of cardiovascular disease. But what I just mentioned already isn't actually yet testing genetics. So phenotypically, there's this, and this became a big problem, right? Because what I just described to you on some people going in a very low carb ketogenic diet, seeing this rise in their LDL, this is different than what, say, Brown and Goldstein were looking at 50 years ago, where somebody was having it from day one. And that's an important distinction, because it was so unlikely that somebody would have an LDL, say, of 190, 200, especially 250, 300, et cetera, that it was an easy conclusion for them to draw, that it must be a genetic abnormality that resulted in it. Now there's an important distinction that I want to make. There's the FH that Brown and Goldstein were looking at resulted in super, super high levels of LDL, such as like 700, 800 for some of the children they were looking at with homozygous FH. That is referred to, since we are going to allow a little bit of technical, something called monogenetic FH. Monogenetic FH are really four of, I would call them the heavy lifters of the limit of the lipid hypothesis, especially. And they have to do with getting back to what I said before, a serious dysfunction in lipid metabolism. So there's a lack of clearance from the vasculature, particularly in, for example, LDL receptor binding. The receptor that are on the cells, especially the liver cells, the hepatocytes, have a tough time grabbing a hold of ApoB-containing lipoproteins and taking them in, right? And that results in a greater amount that's in the bloodstream. And those same children I was talking about that Brown and Goldstein were looking at, they also had high levels of cardiovascular disease. So that became a catalyst moment where FH at that point, it was like, oh, not only do we see this condition for which some people have a high LDL alongside high cardiovascular disease, these children, these poor children, they're having a heart attack at like age six, at age six or seven, and so forth. And so that became a central moment where it was catalyzed that yes, high LDL will result in higher cardiovascular disease at these levels. And then more and more, there were other lines of data that were looked at that that from conventional medicine established that that is the causal directionality.
Yeah. And then there's also polygenetic FH, right?
Yep. And polygenetic FH gets to what you were talking about outside of monogenetic. So poly is now we're actually getting a whole bunch of different types of ways by which LDL levels can be influenced. And because of these larger genetic studies, these GWAS studies and so forth, they're getting to where even granular levels, like there's just a very small divergence of LDL that can then get added to this clustering of others. And that's why it's poly, it's multiples for which they can see. So for example, you may know somebody who doesn't have monogenetic FH, one of those big four, but they might have polygenetic FH, and the poly part actually brings them up to an LDL of say 190 or something. And there are recent studies that show that they're different. Monogenetic and polygenetic at likewise levels of LDL have different outcomes. Monogenetic tends to have a worse outcome. That one change versus the poly tends to have a higher association of cardiovascular disease, but not as high as monogenetic of around the same levels, I believe.
Definitely makes a difference. Check out this review on Warrior from Heart and Soil Supplements. I've been having Warrior for about 3 to 4 months now. Absolutely loving it. My stamina in the gym has increased. Muscle quality has increased. Lifting more weights. Libido is at an all-time high. I've become almost 100% carnivore, and these products are amazing since they're superfoods and we don't get beef in India. Totally recommend it to anyone who can get their hands on these products. Thank you, Heart and Soil. Warrior is our collaboration with George St. Pierre. Yes, the amazing UFC fighter who's now retired. Warrior is a collection of my two favorite organs, George's two favorite organs, heart and liver. All of our supplements at Heart and Soil are from grass-fed, grass-finished beef raised exclusively in New Zealand and Australia. Accept no substitutes. I've been to the farms over there that we source from, and these are happy cows living on green grass, regenerative cows on pasture being rotated. These are the healthiest cows I've ever seen. Definitely the safest, highest quality organs I've ever seen in my life. Not the same as desiccated organ supplements sourced from Chile or South America. Accept no substitutes. Our organs are always packaged in glass because plastic is bullshit. You can find all of our supplements at heartandsoil.co. That's .co. So just to clarify, these people that are lean mass hyperresponders, myself included, these people have not had elevated LDLs their whole life. I have documented LDL levels from medical school when I was eating a diet that was perhaps higher in different fats and higher in probably monounsaturated fat than I have now, and maybe a little lower in saturated fat. My LDL was 120. And I've gotten close to there now, but I've never gotten quite to that back to that level now that I'm eating more saturated fat, more butter, along with more carbohydrates. But to say that I have familial hypercholesterolemia, I guess now my LDL doesn't meet the phenotype. But I just want to clarify that I guess technically in medicine, this is a phenotype, but there's also a real genetic basis of FH, of familial hypercholesterolemia. And what does that result in, Dave? I mean, this is something you and I have talked about a lot. How are people with FH, and we can differentiate polygenetic versus monogenetic, if you want to talk about that with regard to the immunology, versus a lean mass hyperresponder or somebody like myself that has an LDL of 150 at sometimes. How are people with FH different at an immunologic level? Why are these not the same thing? Why is this not a good model system?
Yeah, so two things. One, you literally just said it. It's, as I mentioned earlier, have you had it your whole life? So in theory, somebody could both have a genetic abnormality that results in higher LDL and also be a lean mass hyperresponder. It's possible. But it's true. Most of the time when we're talking about lean mass hyperresponders, and the reason we don't have a lot of overlap of those two populations is usually if you did get diagnosed early on with FH, you probably wouldn't have started a ketogenic diet because you were advised early on to not have saturated fat, to not, you know, to keep fat low, to keep, you know, be more carb-based, et cetera. Okay, so then you get to this other thing that you just touched on, which is a subject I'm very interested in. I'm interested in how much this applies back to the immune response, particularly dysfunctions in lipid metabolism at a cellular level with the immune response. So one of the studies, I believe I've sent it to you. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. It's probably one of my favorites, is where they cultured macrophages, macro being big, phage being eat. Macrophages are amazing immune cells that we rely on a lot. And they're in the subintimal space, clearing away debris. And they are, by the way, major components of atherosclerosis. If you look into an atherosclerotic core, you're going to find typically a combination of necrotic macrophages, some that have like died, and then some that are still attending to it. And they're like emergency workers. They're supposed to get rid of the debris and move it aside and so on and so forth. The present lipid hypothesis posits that these LDL particles, they're getting into the subintimal space, and that by that I mean into the vasculature, into underneath the endothelial cells, and they are getting trapped in these things called proteoglycans. Kind of think of, you know, stocks, if you will. And when they get trapped, they can get modified, and that's when these macrophages come to gobble them up. What they're supposed to do is they're supposed to do anything that's there, any kind of pathogen. They're supposed to take it and then go away. And the present lipid hypothesis is that they often come to an oxidized LDL particle and they get stuck. They consume it, they get stuck, et cetera. Now, getting back to the study with the cultured macrophages of those who have monogenetic FH are different, physically different. They have different expression of receptors. And by the way, they seem to be more responsive. The macrophages themselves seem to be physically different if it's in somebody who has a who's had lipid-lowering therapy. So it's very possible that if you have a monogenetic FH mutation, that if you have FH, it's monogenetic, like those that Brown and Goldstein are looking to, that you do benefit from lipid-lowering therapy in such a way that it's demonstrated, like they do in this in vitro study, such that the macrophages function a bit more like yours and mine. But that's highly relevant to me, and always has been, when trying to piece together why this might be different than these lean mass hyperresponders who have a high concentration, high area under the curve of LDL and ApoB, but do not have some dysfunction in the lipid metabolism at a cellular level, especially the immune cells.
Yeah, thank you for that. So just to give context for all of this, the mainstream lipid hypothesis is essentially positing that more ApoB-containing lipoproteins, which are VLDL, IDL, LDL, right? Technically chylomicrons, although those are ApoB48 and LP little a, are bad because you have more of these particles in the circulation, and in a concentration-dependent manner, these particles are getting incorporated into the subendothelial space on the inside of a blood vessel, where they get stuck to these proteoglycans, this scaffolding like you're talking about. The longer they're retained in the scaffolding, the more they get oxidized, and then they get eaten by macrophages, forming the beginning of an atherosclerotic plaque or a fatty streak, whatever we want to call it. And so I think that something that I've, and you and I have talked about offline, but that I have pushed back on consistently, is that not every elevation, not every increase in ApoB-containing lipoproteins carries the same increase of cardiovascular risk. And I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for Dave. I'll let him give his thoughts on this kind of stuff if he would like. But Dave tries to stay kind of agnostic with all this as he's researching this. But my perspective is that not every elevation of ApoB-containing lipoproteins carries the same cardiovascular risk. And for the mainstream to suggest something like the lipid hypothesis and publish papers like the 2017 European Atherosclerosis Society paper, in which the title is LDL cholesterol causes atherosclerosis, I think those things are confusing to people, predominantly in settings where people are ketogenic or low carb, or just eating more saturated fat from animal foods like butter and less seed oils, and they inevitably, or I should say often, see an increase in LDL and ApoB-containing lipoproteins. And in that situation, if these people are not insulin resistant and have normal thyroid metabolism and normal macrophages and genetics that don't align with monogenic or even polygenetic FH, I don't think that there's an easy case to make. I think it's much harder to make the case, and we should question this much more carefully about the potential increase or lack thereof cardiovascular risk with ApoB. Anything you want to add to that statement, or asterisk or anything, Dave. I'm not saying that's your position. I'm just kind of giving context to all the things we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. You rightly point out that I'm going to continue to chart the course that's more research and truth seeking, acknowledging what the limitations of what have existed in the present data, such that it would inform my interest in developing this research. You know, it's fascinating because you go back like 4 or 5 years ago, and me being an engineer, I was a lot more, you know, flamboyant, I guess you could say, in my theorizing and so on and so forth. But particularly as my profile has grown, as a lot more people are listening, as we're getting a lot more into this research, I rightfully and understandably am being more careful about emphasizing the cautious aspects of it. So I'm partnering with a lot of great researchers on all sides. I think that we would all agree on a few things. And one of those is that there seems to be more to the story than what is the existing lipid hypothesis. But even then, with the absolute careful approach to saying, then let's just get the data. If there already were people who were turning down treatment that was being advised to them, then this is a natural history experiment. It's one of those cases where you just go to the people who are already deciding on their course of action and you say, well, do you mind if we at least scan you at the beginning of this and scan you also at the end of this? And then that way you're helping to provide some science. What's interesting about that is that a lot of times the pushback is that the experiment itself could actually encourage that behavior. But the counter argument to that is, or it may actually save them. If there are people who are turning down the behavior and it turns out that the data that they were collecting could have informed them on better medical decisions, literally those same patients who are being a part of it, they have the benefit of getting that. And on top of that, all the other non-adherents have the benefit of getting that as well. So truly, the lean mass hyperresponder research could be the experiments that could, or the observational studies that could best establish the lipid hypothesis. I mean, that's, like I said, now that we're getting the levels all by themselves, that's a fair and plausible point as well, because we just didn't have this before. We did not have it in isolation in the way that we do now.
It's a very unique population. And so just to break it down for people, then we'll get into what the experiments are showing so far. What we have here is a unique population of humans, not rats, not hamsters, not snakes or C. elegans, with, quote, elevated LDL and ApoB particles, who are, quote, healthy with insulin sensitivity and have a lean body mass index. And they are phenotypically, they look different than people who generally have high LDL, and they look different physiologically at the level of the macrophage and their genetics from people with familial hypercholesterolemia. And so the question of the study that you and your team are embarking on is, do these people with significantly elevated LDLs have the same increased risk of cardiovascular disease? Do they progress with atherosclerosis the way a baseline population would? And so this is an interesting experiment to do, because if ApoB containing lipoproteins cause atherosclerosis, there's no reason they shouldn't, right? So I'll let you take it from here and talk about the experiment and correct anything I said up to the point.
No, definitely. So, okay. So taking it back to 2019, at that point, after a couple of years of knocking on the doors of lipidologists and just trying to get a study going through the quote unquote traditional routes, I decided to just go ahead and form a science foundation, and we raised the money ourselves, crowdfunding, as you know. And thank you, by the way, to anybody who's watching this right now who helped to contribute to the Citizen Science Foundation to make this thing happen. That's literally what happened. We got enough donations from individuals to just fund this study. And so what we do is, here's the Citizen Science Foundation. Over here is the Research Institute. That's the Lundquist Institute. They're the ones that actually conduct the study. We help recruit the people for them. They then do the scans, and then all the data and the analyses are in-house. And this study was set up. We had talked to Dr. Matt Budoff, who's our principal investigator, to understand how the technology works. The technology is CT angiography. And what they're doing is they're doing a scan of the soft and calcified plaque in the arteries, and it's extremely high resolution. It has a spatial resolution of, I believe it can see plaques down to 1 millimeter or even smaller in some cases. And it, in the way that they're doing it, is that they're going through like readers, it's like in 3D, they can go through and actually spot any and all of the plaques, the stenosis, and a whole bunch of other metrics that they can gather. Well, we're getting 100 of these folks that meet our eligibility criteria, which are about borderline lean mass hyperresponders, from what I was mentioning before. And scanning them at day zero, and then scanning them again about 365 days later. So it's about a year apart. When we were originally doing this, we thought we'd need 5 years. But actually, these CCTA studies, they're often very short because you really can see the change that rapidly. And so because of the exposure, I mean, because our population is in the top 99.9% of LDL for the population, yeah, there's, I mean, they're hypercholesterolemic, unquestionably. Think of the same thing I just mentioned to you just now, the children of Brown and Goldstein. You could easily have put them into one of these scanners. Not that we would, because they're very young. But if you looked 2 years apart, you would have seen a massive change. I don't think anybody would have bet otherwise, right? Okay, so with that said, we're getting the study started. And I'm a little depressed because it turns out there's really, even though we don't have a control, there's really no healthy control groups that are out there, especially healthy populations for which there's already longitudinal data, especially. And I was just, it was very depressing. But what I didn't know at that time was that this other study called Miami Heart was taking place elsewhere. The principal investigator is Karam Nasir, fantastic guy. And I'm so thankful he started this thing because it's a much larger population. I believe it's 2,400, 2,500, something like that. And that's going on, and it's completing right near the time that we become aware of it. And then I go, oh, well, we could do a match analysis. That was one of the things we had talked about early on. And that was a crucial point because I believe it was Matt who initially brought it up in an interview. And at the time that I was interviewing him, and said, of course, we don't have any healthy people to connect it with. He's the one who said, well, no, we can do match controls. And at that time, he knew about Miami Heart and I did not. And so needless to say, right after that, I was like, okay, well, even though we have the longitudinal study that's going to happen anyway, if there's a point in time where the match analysis is possible, let's do it. And that's what happened next. So basically, since we actually kind of got this rolling in February, but there's a lot of process that's involved with it. Finally, the match analysis was able to happen. The biostatistician inside of Lundquist carefully did a match. And what they do is they're, let me back up a step. We have 100 participants at baseline, and they by February have all been scanned, right? For their first of those tests, they've all been scanned, all 100. But the catch is that 20 of those are outside of the age ranges of the Miami Heart cohort. So that's still plenty that we had 80. So of those 80, Lundquist's statistician needs to try to see if there's a matched cohort. Can it get matched for age, gender, ethnicity, all of these things? And it was a very surprising one-to-one match. Like if you see the table at some point, it's really impressive. The key differences are, of course, the LDL, which is what we wanted to be different. BMI was different. I want to say our BMI for our cohort was 22.5, which won't surprise you at all. Gets back to the whole lipid energy model, everything else. And I think on the Miami Heart side, it was, I want to say 25.8. But all the healthy markers, otherwise, everybody's got a very comparable smoking status, blood pressure, HSCRP, A1C, they're so close for a match. And I love that because I like stratification over modification wherever possible. So if you can actually get a match group, that's fantastic. And both groups, very high HDL, very low triglycerides. So finally, the analysis is done. And we found out, you know, a few months ago, but of course we had to stay under the embargo until Matt Budoff presented it this last Friday. So yes, I actually have his slide deck over here now. The results were, the matched mean age was 55.5 years. That's super relevant to me because, frankly, I kind of was looking forward to the possibility we might have middle age population because they're going to be more likely to have plaque than not. And the mean LDL-C of our group was 272. 272. So it's actually about per NHANES. That's about 1 in 1,000 people have an LDL that high. It's extremely rare. And the mean time on the diet, so the mean time likely to be at these levels, it's around 4.7 years. So almost half a decade they were at these levels. And there was no significant difference in coronary plaque burden compared to the Miami Heart Controls, who had a mean LDL of 123 milligrams per deciliter.
You have to repeat that for emphasis. That was the most important part.
Yeah, sorry. There was no significant difference.
Say it louder for the people in the back.
No significant difference in the coronary plaque burden as compared to Miami Heart Controls. So between those two populations, there was no statistically significant difference. What did surprise me, and it comes with caveats when I say this, so hear my whole sentence, right? If the area under the curve were reversed, where those who are on the keto side, it was statistically non-significant, but trending up compared to Miami Heart, I think many people would conclude, okay, so maybe they're not there yet. It's a slower process, but that's where they're headed. So that's the only reason I bring it up. I don't want to give the impression that the people in our group are just straight up doing better, because again, it's not statistically significant. But it does lead me to believe that they're not trending toward worse thus far. And I think that's a responsible way of sort of putting that. But then there's another thing that's super important that I really was looking forward to, because now we had a large spectrum of LDL levels between both groups, right? So you had in our group, the LDL, of course, could be as low as 190, or I think even possibly lower in some cases, going up to as high, the person with the highest was 591 milligrams per deciliter, their LDL. So it's almost 600, right? And now you could correlate that against the TPS, the total plaque score. So how much did LDL correlate to the total plaque score? And you can see that in the graph pretty easily. There's no correlation. There's no correlation in our group or in the Miami Heart group. There's just no correlation between detected LDL levels at baseline and resulting plaque, which again would counter expectations if looked at context independently. So that's basically the core of the results.
That's awesome. So let me just reiterate that for people. So we have in your group 80 people out of the 100 who you can find age match controls for at Miami Heart, who have been on a ketogenic diet with low carbs and elevated LDL, an average of 272 milligrams per deciliter, 100 out of 100 cardiologists prescribing statins for those people before they walk out the door. But those people are not on statins. And they've been on this diet for an average of 4.7 years. So this is not a short amount of time. And as you said earlier, the interesting thing about CT coronary angiogram is that it's very sensitive. This is different than a CAC, than a coronary artery calcium score, something that I've talked about in the past that I did on myself. I've never had a coronary CTA, but it's something I want to do in the future. So the CT coronary angiogram looks at both calcified and soft plaque. There was some misunderstanding about this online, apparently. And you can be very sensitive. So even the fact that you have baseline data on these people now gives you how much plaque burden is there in a group of people with an average LDL of 272 milligrams per deciliter for an average of 4.7 years. And you see some, but when you compare that to an age match control from Miami Heart, there's no statistically significant difference. So relative to a group of people who have a much lower LDL, the amount of plaque burden is essentially at a statistical level equivalent. Though, as you're noting, your group is trending lower. There's not enough power in the study with only 80 to 80 comparison to make that a statistically significant difference, but you have a trend toward lower, which is incredible. And if you are able to share the slides with me, I'll put some of the slides from your presentation up on this podcast on YouTube so people can see this. There's no correlation between the level of LDL and the plaque burden in either of these two groups, presumably in Miami Heart. It's because it's also a group of people who are relatively healthy and have other proxy metrics suggesting they are insulin sensitive. Your group, we know, has low triglycerides, high HDL, part of this triad that we've looked at, proxy marker of insulin sensitivity. So this is pretty interesting because, as we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, and this is my words, not yours, if ApoB causes atherosclerosis, then why does your group with a very elevated LDL for an average of 4.7 years not have a statistically significant, I would say markedly different, greater plaque burden than an age-matched control for Miami Heart with lower amounts of LDL? Now, the other piece of the equation for people to understand is that this is not the completion of the study. This is a really important time frame. You're going to scan your people out a year to look at their progression. But in some ways, the data we have now is just as important as the next part. They're both equally important. You're going to look at progression at a year. But right now, we can say, versus an age-matched control, your group is actually trending lower, not statistically significant, but it's trending lower. How can that be if ApoB is causal in atherosclerosis? I think that raises a lot of eyebrows and some interesting questions in humans.
Yeah. For lay people who don't necessarily understand this as well, I like to use the analogy of a prototype. So if you think something can't fly and then you finally say, no, I figured out what I believe will prove that it can. Here, I've done it in this experiment, but it's a prototype. Those of us in technology know that you can get really excited about prototypes, but you still acknowledge that you want to reproduce it, to gather further data, et cetera. That would be, of course, my understandable caveat in this case, is there is the lipid hypothesis as we all understand it to be context independent, that whatever the population, you're going to see relatively a higher plaque burden compared to a likewise population if the LDL and particularly the ApoB is higher. This is unquestionably, I think, very fascinating data wherever you stand on that topic. But naturally, I'll say, A, the study is still ongoing. This is preliminary, even if it is a match analysis. For example, we will have the second scans, in which case the average will obviously move to 5.4 years. And then we can do a second match analysis, which will be a little bit better informed because now we'll have 5.4 years versus the controls, as well as having the longitudinal data in hand also. But yes, that said, as I'm sure my co-authors would want me to reiterate, this is just the beginning. It's just like it's the start of the conversation. It's not the end of one. But I will take the one W that it was a hell of a lot of work to get to this first step. Man, it was, you know, I think that the one thing that I can really lean into is this is a true story of grassroots effort with science that I'm just so thankful for, that there were so many people that could come together truly from all sides, from helping on the contribution side to helping on the recruitment, which is itself a huge process, to the travel, to getting all of the connections for everybody who's involved on the research. And it took a huge amount of effort because I'll again remind everyone, I'm an engineer. I'm truly a fish out of water on this one. I started this because I kept thinking I just handed off to some other scientist because it would just be way too novel for them to not want to do studies on. And I found that, no, this is the only way it was going to happen. And thank goodness there was such a community all around us that could empower that to be true, that we could make it happen together. And that's what I think is maybe my favorite moment of all, is that we're proving to these research centers like Lundquist that, hey, it doesn't have to have a business case behind it. So it doesn't have to be a company and it doesn't have to be NIH. There is this third way. And we can maybe get back to just some straight science again.
I hope so. I want to highlight something you just said. Back to the lipid hypothesis. The lipid hypothesis as it stands, and I'm reiterating something you said, is context independent. The lipid hypothesis does not allow for context, which is something that you and I have been trying to beat the drum about for years now. The context in which, I'll speak for myself, not for Dave. I believe that the context in which ApoB exists is hugely important. And I hope studies like this will continue to have people question the idea of a context-independent lipid hypothesis. I also want to go further to say that in my work and in what I've talked about, I don't think humans should ignore an ApoB. I think you should know your ApoB level. I think you should know your LDL. I think you should know what your thyroid is doing. Your T3, your free T3 had better be in the normal reference range. You should know what your genetics are doing. You should know your insulin sensitivity. You should have a fasting insulin. You should probably have a fasting glucose. You should be lean. You should be healthy. You should be a healthy human. Those, for me, are the contextual variables by which we are looking at ApoB. And what I have hoped to see happen and integrate into the conversation are these contextual variables. It's not something that's happened to this point. And I'm excited that this study will continue to challenge people in a context-independent lipid hypothesis, because that simply, to me, is flawed and incomplete. And I think that not every elevation of ApoB carries the same increase of cardiovascular risk. So it's not to be ignored. I think that oftentimes when I've come out in the past and said things about LDL, people will misconstrue what I'm saying. It's not to be ignored, and context matters. But I think that, as we've said, there's not much discussion, if any, about context in the current ApoB paradigm. Dave, what has the medical community's reception to this data been like?
It's been a mix, that's for sure. I think that, understandably, a number of folks are they're cautious on their approach, given it's just so different from what their expectations are. There are many who've brought up limitations with the study design, many of which we've acknowledged in advance anyway. But again, we should invite them all. Like, we should invite like everything that anybody could say. But a lot of this study design was in expectation of that, was in knowing the things that I think I would be critical of and the things that I think other people would be critical of, such that that's something that we needed to bear in mind for it to be strong data. And that was a key, you know, that was a key factor. I think probably the most prominent one would just be that our population at baseline is healthy, that we excluded cardiovascular risk factors, but that was, of course, by design. Like, getting back to the context independent aspect, right? We needed to pass an IRB. You can't go to an IRB and say we want to allow people to not have therapy who have existing cardiovascular disease, for example, right? That's a no-brainer. But that's okay, because that was the whole point, was we wanted to get people who are healthy with extremely high levels of LDL and then capture how much direct. Like, I think it really, I'm going to really draw out that point that I was making earlier, because I think a lot of people miss this when I'm trying to bring it to everyone's attention. Me personally, as an engineer, I want to get under the hood. I want to just look right at the thing that's getting talked about. And I don't like to get into models, and I don't like to get into suppositions and adjusted, you know, data. I want to see the direct relationship of LDL concentration and its association with the outcome of plaque formation. Full stop. I don't want dysfunctions as a part of the larger picture. And I don't want anything that has to get, as much as I can get the focus on just variable X and outcome Y, in this case, the happier I'm going to be. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the first one. I don't know of any study that does specifically exclude any form of dysfunction or abnormality with the intention of looking at metabolically healthy folks with extreme, prospectively, looking at metabolically healthy folks with extremely high levels of LDL and the outcome of plaque formation, full stop. It seems like a no-brainer. And so, yes, I'm hoping that this will get further interest to gather further data just like this.
Dave, we can cut this next part out of the podcast if you want, but I've got to read a tweet. Tom Dayspring tweeted, "Why would anyone care what those with zero lipid, lipoprotein credentials, publications, prestigious teaching or lecture lists, or clinical training or licensure spout? Internet babbling and podcasting are not credentials." This one kind of pissed me off the most because Tom Dayspring is an MD. I'm an MD, and he and I have had disagreements online. But I just thought, it made me think about, maybe we can put in a little snippet of the woman on the doctors. When I went to the doctors, I don't know if you've seen the clip when I went on the doctors, but there's this obese lawyer, and she's gathered a couple of funny monikers online that I won't repeat, but she looks at me and she goes, "What makes you an expert?"
It's up to us to educate ourselves. Just because there's a degree that says a doctor doesn't mean that we have or don't have medical nutritional knowledge.
The bottom line is you practice psychiatry. Am I correct?
I practice medicine.
I practice medicine. So what makes you an expert in this?
Because an expert in what? An expert in understanding human physiology? This is medicine. The separation of humans into organ systems doesn't serve the patient. To say that because I'm a psychiatrist, I don't know about nutrition is a completely...
I didn't say that.
That's
your
what you
expertise
were inferring.
That's
what
the
you
mind.
Were inferring. Well, where does the inflammation come from that causes depression and anxiety? It comes from the body. It doesn't come from the brain.
It's a scary thought process that is all you need to do is read articles to make you an expert. I want to know what kind of testing you've done, what kind of data you have, what you yourself have found regarding these issues.
And I'm thinking of Tom Dayspring looking at you, you know, Dave Feldman, this intelligent engineer who's asking out-of-the-box questions from a humble perspective and saying, "What makes you an expert, Dave?" And I'm just kind of laughing at myself going, man, people are so petty, you know? Why would someone care what someone with no lipid training thinks? And it's like, and I think, well, Tom Dayspring, if you think that credentials give you any sort of pass, you're dead wrong. And I think that we should welcome ideas and out-of-the-box thinking from everyone. So, yeah, I just had to put that in there, Dave, because it was just, I think that this kind of bullshit should be called out.
Let me give my nuanced answer to that. And I might surprise you a little bit, but quite literally, I've said this multiple times, quite literally, I think of Peter Attia and I think of Thomas Dayspring as the beginning of my understanding of lipidology. And I am endlessly thankful. I take the opportunity to say this. I'm thankful for Attia's Straight Dope on Cholesterol. And I'm thankful for Dayspring's lecturepad.org, which I think is defunct now, but it had his lectures on it. I learned a lot from both of them. And I can compartmentalize the enormous importance of the genesis of me. I mean, I that's a lot of how I got to where I'm at right now. While also acknowledging that many of my critics, even the ones who've changed gears on me, coming from a good side to not so good side, I really do think most of them are well-meaning, that they genuinely feel like this research is concerning and that it's going to give people hope for something that actually is ultimately going to harm them. And I think it's fine to acknowledge that aspect of it. I will say, in my defense to the thing that you brought up before, credentialism, it ultimately comes from what it is that you are developing with regard to the science that's being looked at by the domain of the credential. So it's fair to say that, but to an engineer, that's just not as interesting. I'm in a world of technologists who don't care as much about credentialism, which is probably why I sort of moved forward with this without trying to do, say, what Dr. Bernstein did and actually try to become like an entire doctor. I thought that perhaps I could accomplish getting a study together, getting all of the foundations laid to make this thing happen. And to that extent, I think that's my resume, right? That's that, along with all of the papers that have been published to this point. I have to thank Nick Norwitz and Adrian Sotomoda and the amazing team of doctors and researchers that we have that we published all of this under now. My hypothesis has ultimately made its way into the literature to the extent to where I can appreciate that we'll now have that in place for when this study is completed to provide some, you know, some consideration. At the end of the day, a lot of the people who care a lot about the credentials probably aren't that initial audience of people who are going to be taking the close look at this. But that's who I know is going to be the next step, frankly.
That's an important point you bring up, that there are multiple papers that have been published in literature with regard to these topics. I know Dr. Matt Budoff is going to publish an abstract of these findings formally in the near future. And you guys have published multiple papers here. Has Peter commented on the results, Dave? We know what Thomas Dayspring has said, but has Peter weighed in?
Not that I'm aware of, but I mean, to be sure, at the time that we're recording this, it's less than 72 hours from when the presentation from Budoff came out. I would not be surprised, given literally almost everybody we know who's opined on this topic before seems to have commented on this drop, because of course it really lit up the internet. But yeah, I would be interested. I'd be interested to know what his thoughts are. I'd be interested to know what anybody who's had an interest in this research would think.
Interesting. And I think you brought up another point earlier that's important to highlight as well, which is that I think that when people see studies like this and they see conversations like the one that we are having, sometimes there is this perspective that we are potentially doing harm by preventing people from going on lipid-lowering therapy, whether it be a statin, a PCSK9 inhibitor, et cetera. Why would you not put someone on a lipid-lowering therapy with a elevated ApoB level, Dave/Paul? And you hinted at this, but I just want to make sure we highlight this for people. Those criticisms are not... Those potential problems are not one-sided. I think that consistently, and again, this is my perspective, I'm not speaking for Dave, that and I've had people on the podcast to talk about this multiple times. I think that with regard to statins and multiple other types of lipid-lowering therapies, the potentially negative side effects are downplayed. And there is well-documented industry collusion, hiding of data with regard to statins to minimize the data with regard to potential statin side effects or other drugs. So this is not a position where you're saying, why are these people not doing exercise, Dave? This is something we all agree on is healthy. You're preventing them from exercising, or you're convincing people not to exercise. This is we are looking at people and trying to add an argument for context with regard to LDL and ApoB versus in a rote, potentially, this is my criticism of the medical establishment, not Dave's, in a rote, or I would say reflexive way, placing people on medications. As I said earlier, from my perspective as a physician who worked before going back to medical school as a physician assistant in cardiology for 4 years, more than 4 years, 100% of these people would get a statin from 100% of the doctors that they see. And other drugs too. Probably a lot of them would get put on PCSK9 inhibitors, Repatha, et cetera. And so these are not benign interventions. And what you mentioned earlier that I've attempting to highlight here is that potentially having this conversation helps people avoid the negative side effects of unneeded medications if there is an intelligent, research-supported discussion of the way that context determines or changes risk with ApoB. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that the context I would throw in is... This is a good example, I think, of something that I'm literally watching in real time. And I want to be cautious because I'm going to be now stepping into a territory that I don't normally do. I try to emphasize to everyone that I'm just on the research side, which is the horse. I'm avoiding the cart, which is the medication to do something about said research, right? And I think to your point, getting back to the context independence, if you have high LDL, it doesn't matter what the context is, whether you're primary prevention, secondary prevention, whether there's been a, you know, a stent placed, et cetera, all of those sorts of things. I can say that with the doctors that I'm working with right now, they seem to interestingly be correlating a bit more themselves into the position that if you have high LDL, there's a lot more recent data that if you have a zero CAC, that it's probably not as meaningful to take steps to lowering it. Now, again, I don't want to speak for them. And again, I want to emphasize that I'm not going to speak medical advice. I only bring that up because I know those same doctors would feel the opposite if you did have existing disease, if you did in fact have a positive CAC, even if you are primary prevention. So that's my recycling both sides of what they would say and me observing, me reporting the data, if you will, of what seems to be a correlation I'm seeing often. And I believe this is the position of Karam Nasir and Matt Budoff and William Cromwell, all three of which have definitely prescribed lots of statins for the other context in that regard, or other forms of lipid-lowering therapy. So that's kind of my way of actually adding, I think, to your point in what I believe a lot of doctors, even a lot of low-carb doctors who tend to be a bit more permissive, if you will, would feel allows for that nuance, right? Because I do worry sometimes that I never seem to counterbalance enough, even though I'm obviously wanting to pursue this exciting, emergent, novel data, that it's just in this domain. It's just with these lean mass hyperresponders. It's just with these limitations that these were intentionally very healthy folks. But there are a lot of those folks. There are a lot of people, particularly there are a lot of people who are using the ketogenic diet to help medical ailments that, you know, epilepsy, type 1 diabetes, ulcerative colitis, where it's like that, or carnivore in particular, to where it's like this has just been a godsend to them. And the only thing is the high LDL. This data is something that keeps me up at night that I want to get for them in particular. Those are the people that I think are extremely important to have in this conversation. So for everybody outside of it, I'm going to typically say the same thing, which is, of course, you know, work with your doctor for your individual care. But that said, this is, I think, always going to be the first step and a step that we want to see.
And I'll also add to that, that as I said in the beginning of the podcast, when I was strict carnivore, my LDL was significantly higher than it is now, but my LDL remains above the reference range. And I think the majority of physicians that I would see would recommend that I go on lipid lowering therapy. So I think even people who are not at this range of lean mass hyperresponders can find value in this conversation. And there's a question of whether I should be on a statin, right? And this is, again, I think a continuum and part of the same conversation. Is every elevation of ApoB carrying the same cardiovascular risk? I'll also add a caveat to my earlier statements that though I'm not going to give out medical advice, I am an MD, and I have gone through lots of years of training and seen lots of people and thought about this a lot and read a lot of things on my own and spoke to a lot of experts and debated a lot of experts. I think that there are situations in which lipid-lowering therapy is probably the better part of valor. People with monogenic FH, people who will not change their other lifestyle risk factors. ApoB is a contextual risk factor for cardiovascular disease. I don't believe it's causal in the way that the lipid hypothesis would suggest that it's causal. But in the recent podcast I did with Derek, he was kind of pressing me and he said, what if somebody has FH? Would you put them on lipid lowering therapy? And I think, yeah, if somebody has monogenic FH and we have documented cases of metabolic changes in the macrophages, there is a case for lipid lowering therapy. If someone has diabetes and is unwilling to change their diet, there is a case for lipid lowering therapy. But I think that similarly, as you're pointing out, there is a strong case that we should consider avoided lipid-lowering therapy if someone is of a different context, like we're talking about now. Again, these are my words, not Dave's. And again, this is not medical advice. This is just my perspective as a human that tends to be pretty darn insulin sensitive.
You're correctly sensitive, especially at this time, for why it is that I would be more sensitive to how much this could affect anybody's medical decision-making with their doctor, particularly with medication. And again, this is why I brought up with the in vitro study on the macrophages that lipid-lowering therapy might literally have an impact on the macrophages themselves of those who had it. There's another also scientific case to make that I'm going to do for other doctors I know who would say, okay, it could turn out that the lowering of LDL for something like statins isn't actually the agent of value. It could in fact be that that's a side effect of what is otherwise providing an agent of value for people with secondary prevention, such as modulating the inflammatory outcome more, or you know, greater nitric oxide expression or something along those lines. And that's all plausible, right? That's why you'd want to do a, that's why you want to do things like RCTs if you can, as independently as possible. But again, I'm always trepidatious about even walking into the territory of cholesterol-lowering medications. It's just that the nuance is something that easily gets lost sometimes in this discussion. And that nuance is best served by the individual relationship you have with your health and the people who you're consulting on it with.
Yes, I think so. Presuming that there is an honest discussion of the potential risks and benefits of those lipid-lowering therapies, which
sure.
From my perspective is not always the case, but should be. So yeah, and the last thing I'll say is that I think that maybe in the future we'll talk again about why LDL goes up in a ketogenic or low-carb diet. For my part, I'll just say that I've seen high LDL with a ketogenic diet, which came down significantly when I added carbohydrates. Maybe I'll let you add here in a moment a brief explanation of the lipid energy model. But I've also observed that even with significant amounts of carbohydrates, my LDL and ApoB remain, quote, slightly elevated. So I think that there's probably multiple things happening for people, potentially this idea of a homeoviscous model of adaptation at the level of a membrane, and which is just the fact that your body may change the amount of LDL in the body when you have more or less saturated versus polyunsaturated fat. And for my audience, I'll also add that I've recently come across evidence that when you feed animals and animal models excess amounts of polyunsaturated fats, predominantly in seed oils, but also occurring in things like fish oils, you do see oxidative stress in the liver, which degrades ApoB100. So one of the mechanisms by which LDL ApoB may go down is the amount of polyunsaturated fats in the westernized diet. And that is not going down in a good way. So my perspective is sort of that not every elevation of ApoB is bad. Not everything that lowers ApoB is good. And we've seen that consistently that seed oils will raise oxidized LDL and Lp(a), both increase markers of cardiovascular risk. So in brief, Dave, and then we'll wrap up, do you want to summarize the lipid energy model and what's going on and why some of these people with ketogenic diets may get so significant elevations of their LDL?
Yeah, let me first say that to the point that you were making, one of the challenges in being able to determine this model or really any model is that I'm already aware from my early self-experiments just how many different things change your lipid levels in an acute fashion. So just behavior of the last few days, I've proven this over and over again, can really alter your lipid levels. However, if you're metabolically healthy and you're powered predominantly by fat, then the context, I think, becomes a bit more predictable so long as you know what those other levers are to control with, right? So basically, this is how the model works. If I'm going to be powered more by fat, particularly if I'm leaner and I'm more metabolically healthy, then it means I'm going to have probably lower levels of hepatic glycogen stores. That's the stored glucose in the liver. And if stored glucose is lower in the liver is your metabolic brain. It knows that and therefore activates greater circulation of fatty acids coming in and out of your fat cells, your adipocytes. And in order for you to circulate those fatty acids at a faster and faster rate globally throughout your body, it needs to resupply both those adipocytes and also to other oxidative tissues in need at a higher rate. And it's doing that by packaging them onto ApoB lipoproteins, but particularly VLDL when we're talking about the liver. VLDL is the ultimately is succeeded by an LDL. after lipoprotein lipase, which is turning it over at a faster rate, releases more of those fatty acids, both to replete the adipocytes and also to power oxidative tissue, like especially skeletal muscle and especially cardiac myocytes. So in short, the circulation overall becomes more relevant because you're doing more bulk supply of those fatty acids back to adipocytes. I assume your audience probably picked up more of that than the average person, just because they're used to sort of the biology that you get into there, right? But in this milieu, you got lower insulin, you got lower leptin, that the liver knows. It knows that it needs to synthesize and secrete and turn over those VLDL at a faster and faster rate. And that means there's more successive LDL and therefore more successive ApoB lipoproteins. But again, it's circular. So it's not like there's literally a huge amount of extra production of these things. It's that more of them are getting recirculated within the body. That's the model in a nutshell.
Right. Because there is this fairly infamous conversation between you and Peter Attia in the past when he was sort of saying, well, mass balance can't work like that, right? So it's not necessarily more of them are getting produced, it's just a circulating level.
Well, and actually I'll hand this to Attia. I wasn't as aware at that time of the structural relevance of the adipocytes itself. Okay, so let me take a step further, because it was, I think, a valid question to an extent, in that the piece that I didn't understand to the degree I do now is the fat cells themselves, these adipocytes. If you're leaner, right, you have less less volume to surface area. And what's happening is you quite literally are expanding and contracting those fat cells, just like you're getting fatter, you're getting thinner, right? But at a tiny, minute level. And these may be small changes, but what's happening is that they need to incorporate more of those lipoproteins. And I believe that we're going to find that there's just greater endocytosis, endo being in, cytosis being of the cell. Literally, your adipocytes are consuming and then in the lysosomes, taking them apart and incorporating them into the bilayer of the cell so that they can expand. So your fat cells are literally pulling in more of those ApoB lipoproteins proportionately such that they can expand, but then by the same token, they will also contract at a higher rate, right? What proves this is my very earliest experiments, quote unquote, the Feldman protocol, where I would tank my LDL cholesterol. How would I tank my LDL cholesterol so much? Consuming a huge amount of fat, especially saturated fat, and proving this inversion pattern. I believe it's because my adipocytes relatively were growing. And therefore, it wasn't just that there was the higher turnover, as I was talking about from earlier, but there's actually that greater endocytosis into the adipocytes. And part of what further supported that was my triglycerides would go down. Why would my triglycerides go down if I'm consuming literally more fat? And my HDL cholesterol went up. And this too, I didn't really know as well, except for 3 years ago with Anatol Kontush's work, who is a co-senior author with me on the lipidermogen model. He would show that these triglyceride-rich lipoproteins I'm talking about that are turning over, when they shrink, they release more of the components of their surface area and get picked up by the HDL particles. So the pool of HDL particles actually grows and HDL cholesterol grows. And that's exactly what happens when I overconsume in a ketogenic ratio. As you'll see my triad, you'll see the HDL go up, you'll see the triglycerides go down, and yet my LDL cholesterol goes down. And it's reversible. If I'm hypocaloric, if I don't consume a lot, then my LDL will go up, my triglycerides will go up, my HDL will go down, relatively speaking, right? So my experiments were teaching me this model. It wasn't just entirely something that I figured out after reading 18,000 papers. It was something that I just kept doing these experiments in succession, and I could see the slicing after time just by the frequency of what was happening. And that's part of what built the foundation on it. Now, all of that said, it just takes going through and getting challenges like the one that Peter Attia, provided to help further establish this.
Didn't Nick Norwitz recently do an experiment where he decreased his LDL cholesterol more than a statin with a stack of Oreos?
Yes. Yes. In fact, it's happening right now. So the first arm leaked, by the way. He was originally intending to keep the entire thing, private until he got the second arm. I don't know if you know what the second arm is. He's going to be doing statins. So he's comparing.
He's actually taking a statin.
Yeah. Yeah. He's on that arm right now. I don't remember how long I don't remember exactly how long he was doing the Oreo arm, but he proved per principles of the lipid energy model that on top of his existing diet, if he consumes all of these Oreos every single day, and he doesn't like Oreos, but Oreos were provocative. People know what they are, and it sounds ridiculous that you could lower your LDL by just adding a whole bunch of Oreos. But per the lipid energy model, his insulin's going up, which means that there's going to be more lipoprotein lipase activity induced by the insulin, but also repleting his glycogen stores. So while he's ketogenic, now his glycogen stores are going up. Therefore, the liver is going to feel less of a need to recirculate fat. Therefore, there's going to be less successive VLDL to LDL conversion. And sure enough, he did drop it substantially to where it was. And I'm afraid I'm going to misquote his numbers, but I know it got down to like very low 100s. I want to say like 112 or something like that. And he's normally up at around like 500. I think he started closer to 400 at the start of the experiment. The point is, he really proved very, very effectively exactly what we were hypothesizing. And now he's on the statin arm. And the statin arm at the end of this, working with Bill Cromwell, will show, you know, what the difference is in how much the LDL lowering has gone. And while I am privy to some information, I of course can't share it. That's for him to share when the thing is finally published. But I will say it's an interesting study design. I think it always was something we knew would get a lot of attention because, of course, it's very provocative.
But nobody is recommending that you take Oreos, that you eat Oreos, guys.
Correct. Don't correct. Even think that. Yes. Thank you for fitting that in. That's part of the point of it.
No, that's it. Let's put a bunch of sugar and carbohydrates in, which I'm a huge fan of naturally occurring sugar and carbohydrates and fruit and honey, not Oreos full of palm oil and other seed oils and processed sugars. Not great for humans, but if you replete the glycogen in the liver, you are going to see changes. And potentially the seed oils in the Oreos are causing oxidative stress and some degree of ApoB100 degradation at the level of the liver. Regardless, we can drop our LDL with dietary things significantly. I've seen that a great deal with mine, as I've talked about. Dave, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people find you, potentially support the Citizen Science Foundation and what you're doing, and follow the rest of the work that you're doing?
Yeah, of course. I'm pretty active on X/Twitter. Real Dave Feldman is my username. It's also my username for Instagram. It's also my username for YouTube. You can go to youtube.com/@RealDaveFeldman. Citizen Science Foundation, yes, is our foundation. And it's something that I've been I'm so thankful, and I never feel like I can say enough thanks to everybody who's been able to help make this happen. And sure enough, we are going to have a big fundraising effort that's coming soon that I think is going to be fun. I think it's going to be exciting to a lot of people. I'll get to tell you more about it offline, but I actually may be officially announcing it tomorrow. So we'll see how that goes. But
awesome.
Yeah, I hope you all consider visiting and continuing to support this research.
I'm excited for people to know that it's happening, and I'm excited for the conversation. Thanks again, Dave, for all your work.
Thank you so much for having me on, Paul.